So I'm going to talk about today a system of equations that I refer to as Schrodinger maps. And these are equations that come out from ferromagnetism. I look around me and I see the world's experts on Schrodinger equation, as well as one of the earliest people who worked on Schrodinger maps before they knew that they were Schrodinger maps. So I will start by explaining the physical problem and go to the mathematical problem in a second. So the problem is very simple. You have a chain of ferromagnetics, and these are the molecules at every site. There is a magnetic spin of magnitude 1. So this is the spin. And they interact with one another by nearest neighbor interaction by trying to rotate each other around their axis. So the dynamics is given to this equation by Heisenberg, and the dynamics is given if I call each site, say, S sub k, then Sk dot is Sk cross Sk plus 1 plus Sk minus 1. So this is the dynamics that Heisenberg wrote down. And of course, once you see a chain of this sort, this is a lattice, and the lattice size, you call it A. Then you can do a Taylor expansion. You assume that the lattice is continuous, and this is the value of the functions at various points. And you do a Taylor expansion where you assume that Sk plus 1, or Sk, is the value of the function u at Ka and t. And you do a Taylor expansion, and you let k go to infinity. Then this system here, just by Taylor expansion, if I do a Taylor expansion of this term, you get the second derivative. So just by Taylor expansion and this system, I get the equation that says dt of u is equal to u cross u xx. And this is the easiest and the first system of magnetic chains that Heisenberg wrote down, and then it's referred to as the Landau-Lefschetz equations of ferromagnetism. And I'm saying this is the one of the earliest people who worked here are Sulem, and Bardos. They wrote a paper about this way early on about this problem. So this is the continuous equation. I'm going to keep the grid size in there, and I'm going to call the grid size A, as I referred to it. So there's a factor of A squared here. There is another model. Oops. Oh. Okay. There is a very similar model to this that describes antiferromagnetics. Now, to tell you the truth, we had a seminar running last year about what is antiferromagnetism, and we had people from IBM coming down to tell us what they are. And they said, we have no idea what they are. This is the truth. And we ask about the models, and they really have no idea what the model is. They know they exist, but they don't have a good intuition to what they are, and they are investigating these. These are things that are used in building hard drives and magnetic memory. So this is why the reason people are interested in them. I'm not going to say anything about that. Very theoretical, pure math stuff. It's applied math by the French standards, but pure math by the American standards. Sorry. Nader is looking uncomfortable at me. Okay. So the antimagnetic system is the one that I like most, which I can say something about, is that you look at two chains superimposed on one top of one another instead of one chain. And at every site, so these are really the same chain, more or less, I think. This is the same site. However, at this site, the elements tend to be working against one another. So you think of two chains superimposed. The distance is still A. This I'm going to refer to as even, as the spin trying to point up, and as odd are the spin trying to point down. Okay? Now, one thing I neglected to say, which is very important, that in all of these models, the spin has unit magnitude. So I should go back here. I can't reach, but I try to do this, that the magnitude of U has to be 1. It's a unit vector in R3. It's a spin vector. I really think about it in this way. So this is odd, and this is even, except the interaction is still by the same law, Heisenberg law. However, now when you want to do Taylor expansion, the elements, you cannot say that the element is close to the one next to it, but it's 2 points away, close to 2 points away, because you have to go from even to even, or from odd to odd. So in the limit, it cannot be described by a single function, but can be described only by two functions, two spin functions, U and V. Both have unit magnitudes. U is the one who's trying to point up, and V is trying to point down. And if we do the Taylor expansion in the model, just to make the long story short, in the same system, but under this hypothesis, then you say S even is going to be U, and S odd is going to be V, and you do the Taylor expansion, what you get is the following system. You get dt of U is equal to U cross A squared UXX plus AVX plus V, and dt of V is V cross A squared VXX minus AUX plus U. And this is the system of antiferromagnetism. Now, as a mathematician, I look at this system and try to understand it. It's an evolution equation, but it looks really as a bad equation from a PDE point of view. What looks bad about it is that it looks as a nonlinear. The nonlinearity is in the highest order derivative term. In fact, if I ignore the fact that U is a spin and V is a spin, then these equations are not well posed. You cannot prove local existence and uniqueness of the system. This is a very important fact, that the magnitude should be 1. Otherwise, these terms degenerate. The cross product becomes degenerate, as we all know.
Now, shouldn't the distance between them be A over 2?
Yeah, maybe I forgot 2s and 4s, but the number of A, the powers of A are more important than that. And thank you for asking this, because I'm going to change the equation in a second. The physicists, and this is really in the physics literature, not my own invention, they don't want to study this equation in time of order 1. They are interested in this equation in times of order 1 over A, after a very long time. So you scale time by A, and then the system reduces A here, but introduces A here. So this is the system that of interest to the physicist. This is the long time dynamics. You go this and you take T into AT, then you get this, or T over A, something like this. Okay? Now, as I said, that these terms are degenerate if I ignore the fact that U has to be magnitude 1. So now let me go back and look at the same problems in a slightly different point of view. And the point of view that I'm going to look at this problem is, this is a motion under constraint. The constraint is forcing me to be on a sphere. So here I'm going to consider in the first problem, U is just a map from one space, one time, into S2. And in the second problem, U and V is a map from one space, one time, into two products of S2. So the setting of these equations, the mathematical setting of these equations, is to look at them as maps into manifolds, but not any type of manifolds. A manifold which have a structure. What does U do to me? Let me simply look at this equation here. If you look at what U cross UXX is doing, it's very simple. I'll write it here and then I'll erase. So what's U cross UXX? Now this is really calculus 1 or 2, depending where you are. You look at UXX, you take the cross product with U. So this is a sphere, and this is U. I can think of U as a unit position, and at the same time, I can think of it as a normal. So if I look at Uxx, Ux is tangent. Uxx is not tangent. It's somewhere around here. U cross Uxx, you first project Uxx on the tangent space, and then you rotate it by 90 degrees. So this product, this operation here is the following. Is first you look at Ux, you differentiate it, you project it on the tangent space of the sphere, and then you rotate by 90 degrees. This is the visual translation of this term. Now let me see what structures I've used from the sphere. Differentiation and projection on the tangent space is a Riemannian structure. I use the metric on the sphere. This rotation by 90 degrees is a complex structure, is multiplication by I. So I use two structures. I use the complex structure and metric structure. So the setting of this problem that I'm thinking of mapping a function U into a manifold which has a metric and complex structure. The setting of such problems I will call a Kähler manifold. Don't worry about this. I will not use it much. If you want to really generalize the problem, just think of any surface embedded in R3. That's the easiest way. You have a surface embedded in R3. You have a unit normal nu. The metric on the surface is inherited from the embedding. And the complex structure is cross product with the unit normal nu of U. So the generalization of this object here is nu of U. This is the unit normal cross Uxx. This is the simple generalization. Now, why do I want to generalize the problem? For two reasons. One is that I want to understand the limit of this equation as a go to zero. And for this, I will be quite lost if I don't view it in a more geometrical terms. So let me tell you how I would view this equation in a geometrical term. Now, a going to zero, the grid size, I did a Taylor expansion in the spin, right? So a is going to zero. Yeah. So now let me look at this problem one more time and explain this one in terms of this language that I've written there. So every... Sure, shoot. Yes. No. I mean, yes and no, right? This is parity. There's a conservation. I mean, you can change U and V. Just two crosses two. They don't view them as this. I mean, again, what we really put them, they give this model, but they say, well, you know, we are giving you that spin up and spin down, the guy from IBM, but we really don't know that this is the case. Yeah, well, this is what I'll try to do in the middle of my talk. So I will look at this equation and really trying to understand, not to distinguish between up and down. And let me do it in a second. So everything I'm going to talk about in this problem about antiferromagnetism is a joint work with Changchun Zhang. So let me explain the problem for antiferromagnetism. The problem here is we would like to understand what happens as A goes to zero. Now, you don't want to understand it under any setting. You are interested in one setting. That is, the equation is antiferromagnetic. U and V are almost working against each other. So you want to understand A going to zero under the hypothesis that you are starting with U plus V is close to zero. So this is the problem that you want to understand. What happens to the limit to this system of equation as A goes to zero? Now, again, I will look at this problem, and to really understand what's going on, I will say the following. I'm starting first with UV, two copies of S2. If A goes to 0, U plus V should go to 0, so U should be minus V, so I go to the anti-diagonal term of S2 cross S2. So as A goes to 0, I should go to something that I want to call U star minus U star, right, where U star is in S2. So the problem reduces to that of a problem on the sphere. So the only thing that is unknown in this problem is that what happens if I try to look at my equation and reduce it, force the motion to be on the anti-diagonal. That's really the problem that we are interested in. Now this problem again has a very nice geometrical interpretation that helped us in solving the problem. So let me give the geometrical interpretation of this problem. So I'm going to forget this here and just draw a picture. You have a complex manifold. And on this complex manifold, you are restricting the motion to half the dimension of the manifold, to a subset which is half the dimension. You have S2 cross S2, but now you are restricting it to S2. This is half dimensions. So you have the motion here. This is your ambient space. Let's call it a manifold M. And you are trying to restrict it on a submanifold of dimension, submanifold L, whose dimension is half M. But it's not any old submanifold, because that will be impossible to do. What turns out to be the anti-diagonal term on S2 cross S2 is what's referred to as a Lagrangian submanifold. So now this is a problem, mathematically speaking. I'm starting with an equation on a Kähler manifold. How do I write Kähler? K-H. You see, I do my spelling before I come to the lecture by preparing my... Yeah, this is what... Yeah, thank you. I'm starting with a Kähler manifold, and as A goes to 0, I want to restrict the motion to a Lagrangian submanifold. Pardon? What's the?
The Kähler manifold.
Ah, it's S2 cross S2. It's S2, S2.
Okay?
I mean, I don't want to go too much into the geometry because I really will not get to any analysis. But this is what I'm saying. I just think of S2 cross S2. Now, and I'm, as A goes to 0, I'm trying to restrict it to a Lagrangian submanifold. And what this is a kind of an optimal size. So let me explain it in this picture here. A Lagrangian submanifold has a tangent space. You have a, since this is a Kähler, it's a complex manifold, you have multiplication by I. If you multiply the tangent space of L by I, you get the normal space. So the tangent space of L, you multiply by I, the tangent space, you get the normal space of L. So you don't miss any direction. It's optimal in direction. This is why you have to be in half dimension. Again, in our setting, this is S2 cross S2, and this is the anti-diagonal term. Correct. This is what I wrote down, the definition. It's okay? Okay. Now, why do we call them Schrodinger maps? So I'm starting with the following, and this is what you're probably asking, Claude, so I'm going to write it now, is that we have a manifold M, I have a metric G, and I have a complex structure G. So this is my complex structure. On a surface, the complex structure J is nu of U cross product. You take the unit normal here, and you take the cross product. G is the metric. So if I have a U, a vector U, dx of U is a tangent vector, the metric G introduces the concept of covariant derivative. This is the projection of the derivative of dx of U. Nothing more. You differentiate and then project on the tangent space. Then you are looking at the equation dt of U is nu of U, is j of U times dx dx of U. And this is the equation that we want to study. This is the first equation that we would like to study. Now, if you ask me what's this equation, well, suppose, let's take the simplest case, M. So, example, M is the complex plane with the standard Euclidean metric and the complex structure I. Then dt of U is I uxx. This is the linear Schrodinger equation. That's the first example you get out from it. I'll give another example, which is the sphere. If we have M is S2 with the standard metric on it, and J is U cross, then what is D of any tangent vector V? You differentiate the vector, and then you project it which is the same thing as dx of v plus v inner product dx of u, u. Just by the fact that v and u are orthogonal, you can move the derivative from one term to the other. So in this case, if I look, what is d dx of u? This is uxx plus ux squared times u. And the equation dt of u is j cross j dx dx of u. Let me translate it by saying dt of u is u cross uxx plus ux squared times u. But u cross u is zero, so I only get uxx, which is the first equation I've written. So this is the first equation. And this is the equation that Bardos, Sulem, and Sulem have studied, and they actually showed that if I look at this equation, the first one at this one, except you really did not care for this one because the cross product is zero, that if you let, you can look at the chain system and let A go to zero, you can construct a weak solution of the system. That is, you can have convergence. That's the first result. Before I go to the antiferromagnetic system, I would like to just say some results about existence of this system. Till what time do I have, actually? Just tell me, and then I will face myself. Pardon? 4 plus minutes to need. So very quick results, just so that we don't... I would really like to get to the antiferromagnetic system, the punchline. Some results on the local well-posedness of this system. This is not an easy system to show local well-posedness for, by the way. It's really quite difficult. But on the local well-posedness results of this system, I can state the following theorems, and not in order of history, but there is a result of Kenning and Nachman in two dimensions, where they do existence of the system in H 3 over 2 plus something of R2. Now, if somebody in the audience is wondering what is the optimal thing you would like to do, the optimal space for these problems in H D over 2. So in two dimensions, it would be H1. This is optimally. There is another result by Nahmad Stefanov and Uhlenbeck in H2 plus of R3. This precedes this result. I stated them in reverse order. These are the local well-posedness result. For weak solution or just for local, for existence in any problem, these were done for the spheres. If you generalize the problem to any Kähler manifold and you ask yourself, when do you have existence for this problem? There are several results. Before I go there, there are weak solutions, existence results. And these are done by simply looking at the problem, doing some Galerkin approximation and going to the limit. Now, for weak solutions, the story is very interesting. There is no weak solutions for the general problem. This is an open problem still. For the sphere case, there is weak solution. Why? You look at the sphere case, it has a divergent structure. Anything with divergent structure is easy to prove weak solution for. If you go away from the sphere case, you lose the divergent structure. And therefore, you don't have weak solutions. For weak solutions, and only for the sphere case, nothing else, there are results by Byzantine, Allusion, Sawyer, about existence of weak solutions, and that is by using Galerkin approximation and passing to the limit of this problem. Just well-posedness for smooth solutions, there are results for just how to construct solutions, not how to obtain a priori estimates. Again, this is not a trivial problem, how to construct solution, because you have to have the target to be on a sphere. There are two results, and I'll just indicate one, Wang, and there is Helena McKagan. And what Helena did is she got existence of local existence, again, of smooth solutions by looking at the problem, looking at solving a wave equation. Solve a wave equation which can be localized in space and time, there is no problem. You can show existence, then there is no problem. Can you get estimates of this equation? And that's what she was able to do, getting an estimate and letting delta go to zero to construct solutions. So this is one method of constructing solutions. I just would point out that the method that Claude, Sulem, and Sulem did would not apply here because, again, they used the structure of the sphere. So I'm going away from the structure of the sphere for a second. The domain is R2, the target is the manifold M, and since I'm more than dimension over 2, then it doesn't matter whether I specify it or not. I'm in L infinity, I can use local coordinates or the embedding. Okay. So let me go to my problem here for a second, and instead of starting with this antiferromagnetic problem, let me walk you through the last 5 minutes of my talk of the work that Changshun and I have done through a simpler problem. The simpler problem, depending on your preference, start very simply with the complex plane. You are in the complex plane, and you have a Schrodinger equation on the complex plane, and now any curve in the complex plane is Lagrangian. You take any curve, you take the tangent vector, you multiply it by I, you get the normal vector. So there is nothing, no problem here. So I'm going to take the easiest Lagrangian curve, and this is the real axis. So on here, I have V1 and V2. U is V1 plus IV2. And I'm starting with solutions in the neighborhood of V1. So my initial data is close to V1. And the equation that I want to solve, I start by writing down the energy. That's easier for me. I look at the integral. I have A dx of u squared. This is the exchange energy. That's the first term in my system. I'm ignoring the middle term. And then I put 1 over A V2 squared. So now if I think of this as my energy, and I start with data exactly V2 equal to 0, and let A go to 0, then I'm forcing V2 to stay to be 0. So I'm starting initial data here. I'm going to solve the Schrodinger equation with this energy. This is the Hamiltonian. Let's call this H. So I solve dt of u is IH prime of u. I start here. My solution would never live here. We'll do something like this. Let u go to 0, what happens? Let A go to 0 and see what happens. This is the problem that I'm interested in. Okay? Now, let me write this explicitly, this equation here. I'm going to write it as dt of u is I. Here I have minus a uxx from the derivative of the Hamiltonian, and then plus 1 over a, and I'm going to write it some function, the derivative of some function of g prime of u. G of u is V1 squared, is V2 squared, sorry. Now, so this is the system that I'm considering, and the question is, what happens if A goes to 0? And for this one, you can argue heuristically. Just look at this system here and tell me what happens if A goes to 0. If you have all the estimates you need in the world, there are no estimates missing. You have H1, H2, H3 estimates. If you do have them, just go to the limit in this system. If you go to the limit in this system, and let's say U converges to something, let's call it P. I'm running out of letters. So I have dt of P should be equal to I. This drops out. This, what will this converge to? It will converge to g double prime of p times some vector c, where c is the limit of v2 over a. Well, I introduced a new unknown, which is the limit of v2 over a, so I better look at what does g prime of u over a dt converge to. So I differentiate this with respect to t. This is very heuristic computations, and I get g double prime of u times ut over a. But ut over a is minus I uxx plus 1 over a squared g prime of u. Now, let A go to 0 and see what this converges to. So from here, I get that dt of g double prime c converges to g double prime of p acting on minus ipxx. And now I'm running. I have to expand this in a Taylor expansion and go to the limit. And if you allow me, since I'm really running out of time, I'll write down exactly what the answer is. So this whole thing goes to the second derivative of the composite function g double prime g prime acting on c x c. So this is just a Taylor expansion. So let me write it down here. That I'm going to have a system where dt of p is I g double prime of p c, and g double prime of p c dt is going to be g double prime of p times minus I p x x plus the second derivative of g double prime I g prime acting on the vector c x c. This is from the Taylor expansion. And thus, what one obtains from this system automatically is a wave equation d to tp minus, equal I g double prime of p minus I txx plus the second derivative of g double prime I g prime acting on xc. What is xc? Xc I can compute it in terms of dt of p. So this is some function applied to dt of p, dt of p. And it should really have g double prime inverse, g double prime inverse. So this is the heuristic limit. The second derivative of the composite function, g double prime of I g prime. This is the second derivative of whatever this function is. Now, when is this heuristic computation? When can you make sense out of it? In order to make sense out of it, you need the estimates. But before you do any estimate for this equation to make sense, you all should look at me and tell me, you should require g double prime to be positive. Because if g double prime is not positive, then this is an ill-posed problem. It's not hyperbolic. Right? If g double prime is positive, it's hyperbolic. Well, you impose this condition. Obviously, the limit requires g double prime is to be positive, so you better impose it from the beginning. So if g double prime is a positive definite matrix, can you obtain a priori estimates to go to the limit? And the answer is yes. You can. So this is a theorem in case g double prime is positive. Positive definite matrix. And it does not depend on what I've written here. It can be into any Lagrangian submanifold. Okay? So what is this equation here? Well, if you do it on a manifold and not in the complex plane as I tried to do it, this equation will be a wave map type equation. So the theorem here, theorem A goes to 0, then the solution U converges to P, where P solves a wave map type equation. Why is it a wave map type equation? Because g double prime is not the identity. If g double prime happened to be the identity, then it's exactly wave map. Oh, this has to be the identity and this has to be zero. Then it's exactly a wave map equation. So it's a generalized wave map equation. Now, this is good enough for the general problem. I started with a very concrete problem. The concrete problem I started with is the antiferromagnetics, which had the same structure here and here, and I had a middle term. This middle term, it can introduce complications. And I will just stop by saying, it's precisely for this problem that you can show that A goes to zero, and here I'm going to say this is the antiferromagnetic equation, that what you end up with is precisely the wave map equation. For people who know what the wave map equations are, they don't this limit is very critical depending on not only on the structures of this being positive definite, the second derivative, but these numbers being precisely 1. You'll be very surprised that you lose the estimates if you change this number to 2, for instance. So it only works for the antiferromagnetic equation that you get this limit. So we start from a Schrodinger type equation. A complicated systems, we have no understanding of the dynamics, there is no existence theory for the system in energy space. In the limit, you end up with a system which we know much more about. We know how to solve, we know when singularities develop, at least in more than 2 dimensions, in 3 or more we know everything about the singularity, and we have a proper theory. And this convergence is strong. So I'm going to stop here. I ran 5 minutes over.